UCR podcast.
So you and I left off in the 90s with the Counting Crows, and today we are going to move the clock back to the 80s to revisit the moment when NXS were really on the rise. As we discuss in our conversation today with NXS co-founder and guitarist Tim Ferriss, the Australian band's early albums, starting with their self-titled debut in 1980, gave music fans a chance to witness a group that was on the rise and growing up in the studio with noticeable progression and further innovation every single time they put out an album. By the time they got into the 90s with records like Welcome to Wherever You Are and Full Moon Dirty Hearts, they were global superstars, able to go in any direction creatively that they wanted to, and that's something that was always consistent about the work of NXS. They were always recording really interesting sounding music that pushed the envelope of technology. 40 years ago this year, they took a major step forward with the release of 1985's Listen Like Thieves, and as Tim tells us, they're a huge, huge album kick, which followed just 2 years later in 1987, would not have been possible without the sounds that they put down on Listen Like Thieves. In 1985 and 1986, it was hard to escape the music of NXS. The title track and What You Need are just two of the songs from Listen Like Thieves that were all over the radio and MTV, and the guys from NXS were officially on a rocket ride that would continue for the next decade. Listen Like Thieves has been newly expanded, featuring a fresh remix of the entire album, done by longtime band associate Giles Martin, an extra disc that gives a fly-on-the-wall perspective of the band's time in the studio working on the record, and there is also a previously unreleased live show from the tour for Listen Like Thieves, recorded live at the Royal Albert Hall. It's Matt Wardlaw. Thank you for checking out the UCR podcast once again. And if this is your first time listening, make sure to follow us so you will receive future episodes as they're released. And you can write us with questions and commentary about the podcast, staff@ultimateclassicrock.com, and read what we're saying about NXS and so many other bands and artists at Ultimate Classic Rock. Here's our conversation with Tim Ferriss of NXS. One of the things that I've always been impressed by is just the rapid evolution of the band. And I think you really hear that particularly once you get to Listen Like Thieves. Like, you guys just really start on a big roller coaster with this record, I think. But if we look at the first four albums that came before this one, like, it feels like as fans, we were kind of getting a chance to watch the band grow up collectively in the studio with each record. I wondered how it felt from your perspective.
That pretty much summed it up, actually. It's interesting you say that, because the album immediately before Listen Like Thieves, Shabu Shaba, we made in the same studio, and it was, you know, it was a million miles in technology and leaps and bounds from where we'd previously recorded, you know, with old tape machines catching fire and engineers falling asleep from having too much whiskey in their coffee. And, you know, it was, we were in the, we kind of felt like we were in the big leagues with Mark Opitz and recording Shabu Shaba and touring on the back of that through the US and whatnot. And it was actually in Japan, I think, Chris Thomas first saw us, but then getting to work with Chris was very exciting. He came in and met us all at the Palladium in Los Angeles and told us what, you know, everything he loved about the band. And he'd seen us also, I think we were opening for the Pretenders in Dallas somewhere. And because he's great mates with Pretenders, obviously, having produced all their records. So, you know, he came backstage at the Palladium and said, look, you know, you guys just are amazing live, which is a great compliment coming from him. And I really want to try and capture that live feeling that you have. So we're going to try and put a PA in the drum room so that it's, you know, and put some of the instruments through that, and so that when Johnny's drumming, it gets that sort of live on stage sound in the drum room. And we thought, okay, whatever, you know, that can be Johnny's little hell, you know. And if he wants to hit the drum so hard, he can make himself as deaf as he likes. But the whole process with Chris from where to go was, Steve Churchard, the engineer as well, had come straight from doing the the Stranglers record. And I was a big fan of that record. So I was stoked with the whole team. It was very exciting. So, so we were like the, kids in a candy shop. We were really excited about everything. And we, went out with great gusto, and Chris really wanted us to rehearse the songs beforehand so that we could play them live as well in the studio. And it was more of a case of like what not to play in the end. Trying to like just really hone down the parts, each individual's parts and whatnot. And except for Michael, because often Michael would still be writing his parts as he was singing them, which is nothing new about that. And that carried that he was like that right till the end, and in a way that's good, that's sort of how it should be, I think. In fact, when I'm in the studio myself doing my own personal stuff, I take a leaf out of his book, and right before I send stuff off to be mixed, I'm like, maybe we should just do this, but I learned a lot from Chris. In fact, I'm seeing Chris on Monday night for dinner. He comes out to Australia every year. We started the sessions with hearing lots and lots of stories from Chris about, Chrissy Hynde running around after John Lydon on outside the townhouse studios out on the ledge, where they could have either of them fallen to their death just like that, whether it be the Beatles, recording sessions or mixing Dark Side of the Moon, all that sort of stuff. He's just never short of a story. So it was really inspirational, and it was a big leap for us, and one we felt we had to hold on to for the next record kick.
Well, you were talking about like basically him having you kind of play the songs together to get them ready to where you could just kind of play them live. Like, and that's something I wondered, like, even before he asked you all to do that, how were you guys fixed for songs? Like how long, obviously things are really busy for you guys in the 80s. Like, but how long had you guys been living with these songs even before he said, hey, let's do this? Like had there been some of the songs that had been around for a minute before you kind of had to jump in, or were they all pretty fresh?
Good question. They're all pretty fresh because as you said, we grew up as a live band. So we were constantly playing or touring and with little time for anything else. So it wasn't very often that we'd get to try out a new song unless we allocated time to rehearse. Sound checks were quick, until we started owning arenas and stadiums and stuff, and you take your time and just tell people to fuck off, we want to do this, up until that point, time was really precious. So, we would virtually be learning the songs and deciding on the songs actually. Andrew had back then it usually worked that Andrew had a whole tape of music ideas, and we'd all listen to them and decide which ideas we liked the most and sort of turn them into songs from there, particularly Michael with Andrew writing Michael would write the melody more often than not. But Chris, the other thing about Chris was he wanted to hear everybody's songs, particularly on that record. And, and he was in on the song choice level as well. So we would rehearse them in the studio and learn them or write our own parts, etc. And demo them in the studio and then record them, like I said, virtually live, which completely, I mixed up. Sorry, I said Shabu Shaba was the immediate record before. It wasn't. It was obviously The Swing, which was made completely differently with Nick Launay at the Manor in England, where he wanted everything recorded kind of live to get the rhythm track. But he was so into the isolation of instruments that he preferred us to play individually. Right down to Johnny's drums, stripped down to snare, kick, hats, overheads. You know, it was kind of a complete, and he had absolutely no fear of cutting 2-inch tape. That was like, you know, to edit, there was bits of 2-inch master tape, you know, all hanging from tape all around the studio walls, which is so different from Chris. So it was great fun too. And I mean, we'd come sort of full circle, because before we recorded The Swing, we actually had worked with Niall on Original Sin in New York. Yeah. Power Station. Yeah. And that was just a party, you know, and that was Niall's way of getting the most out of the band, was partying, which we spent most of the time doing on the road anyway. So that was, you know, again, we recorded that song live too, pretty much, you know. And then Niall was like, do you mind if I play a little? I was like, yeah, you know. It was, for me, it was amazing, because he was my kind of hero. And it was largely due to me playing the band, Niall's solo album, The Land of the Good Groove, on the tour bus, you know, driving everyone nuts with this Nile Rodgers stuff and Bowie's Let's Dance, that we ended up working with him. But anyway, so, you know, we were on this roll with producers and recording, and it just seemed to flow into with Chris Thomas, and Chris really understood the band, and his whole sort of way of producing was to bring the most out of the individuals in the band, so that you'd hear the you know, Kirk's character in the music, you know, and you'd hear Johnny's, you know, way of playing on the tracks, and we started realizing that while we were recording with him, and it wasn't till we actually recorded What You Need, which was the final track, because Chris was like, we just need one more song. You know, there's one more song we need for this record. You know, and we still hadn't done one of my favorite pieces of music Andy had on his demo tape. And that was basically the bass line with the dang, you know, from What You Need. And I'm like, I reckon this is a song, guys. I reckon we've got to work on this. And Chris Thomas is like, yeah, I agree. Look, you guys work on it over the weekend, right? And we'll come in again on Monday, and we'll see where we're at. And we had the song basically rehearsed and ready to go for that Monday, and we laid it down that day. And then we were off we went to this nightclub called Benny's, which was in the place called King's Cross in Sydney, which was a renowned party area. And there was this nightclub, and we put it on, and the DJ put it on, played it really loud. And we were like, yeah, this sounds really good. So it was a really fun record to make.
That's something that really kind of came to mind as I was listening to this, you know, the new remix, and just like the set as a whole, is that I don't know where you place it, Tim, but it's just like, at the very least, I just in memory, I certainly hear it with like Shabu Shuba forward, perhaps, that like, particularly once we get to Listen Like Thieves, I could just hear, to me, what sounds like you all collectively and individually were thinking a lot about your tones and the sound of the band. Because like, for instance, like, the guitar tone on this record, like, it's like, it really sticks out. Like, it's like, when I hear that, it's like, I know that's you guys. And we could go instrumentally through the rest of the record. It's like, there seemed like there were some really conscious choices that were made. Like, did that kind of get elevated with this record? And how much was Chris into that kind of thing?
Very much. That's really observant of you to note that. Yeah. And the reason I kind of got confused, left the swing out of it in a way, is because in a way Shabu Shaba was more aligned with Listen Like Thieves as a record and a sound, you know? And it's because both those producers thought the same way about the band. And So, yeah, Chris, that's why he wanted the PA in there with Johnny when he was drumming in the drum room. And we worked hard with Steve Churchyard, the engineer, because he'd say, you know, what are some of your favorite guitar sounds? And I really liked it, you know, the Ice Queen from the Stranglers record, and just some of those songs to me were like, the Cure, you know, were some of their guitar stuff, because that's back in the days of the JC120, you know, being this incredible stereo chorus sound that was so popular in the 80s. But it was quite sort of new in those sort of early, you know, years of the 80s. So I was trying to come up with this way of blending the JC120 with my Marshalls, which I did live. I had, you know, I used them both in conjunction with each other, but I used them in the studio as well as a combination. And that sort of formed my sort of sound. And Andrew, you know, was doing his own thing with his keyboards. And the Kirk's use of sax kind of really under Chris really kind of became a sound too, a bit more of a signature sound. So it was a growing process, I think, for us musically, and as I was saying before, that trying to get our personalities out through the way we played and the sounds we created in the studio to Chris was really important. More in some ways, it was more important to him than anything else. He really wanted us to sound like INXS. That was his way of putting it. You know,
yeah, and it's like you take a journey with this record. Like, for instance, I love the way "Shine Like It Does" segues into "Good and Bad Times." Like, that's super cool. Was that, like, how early in the whole process did it come? Because I feel like when I'm listening to like what I'll call the sessions disc, which is the second disc on this, you know, new reissue, like that was already, it seems like that was already kind of a thought that was in mind even then. So I wondered how early that thought came to kind of put them together like that.
Well, that's what, Chris Thomas is your classic producer, you know, I mean, he came from the George Martin school of producing, you know, I mean, George Martin was his first boss. So, I'm surprised he didn't wear a suit, but he, from the get go, he's thinking of an album, you know, which is something, you know, we think of a collection of songs and we live in the moment more as musicians and as a band. We didn't really get, although we kind of did with Kick a bit, I suppose, but with that record and Shabu Shaba, they were always the strongest songs and for us, whereas Chris is always thinking, okay, now this song's going to like go really nicely with that one, and then on the other side of the record, you know, which is probably a completely alien thing to say to young people today, but you know, you have these songs, you know, and this song's going to flow really nicely out of that one. And he's thinking of all that as we're recording them and as we're choosing the songs, something that never even entered our heads. And he didn't actually vocalize that. He didn't sort of specifically say, I'm thinking this, I'm thinking that, I'm thinking this, I'm thinking that. He just, it just come out of his decisions about, you know, what songs we were going to do and how they were going to, you know, and how he prioritized them, I suppose, in a sense of recording them. But he's told me this since that's how it was, you know, that's how he was thinking, as opposed to at the time, you know, because we don't want to sit down with Chris and hear, you know, so what are you thinking about this record, Chris? You know, it just, you know, we'd be having too much fun doing stuff. And that was an important aspect as well, as to, have a lot of fun while we're in the studio.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thing you brought up, like, because the thing, the aspect I was not thinking about when thinking about Listen Like Thieves as we're talking about it is the idea of vinyl and, like, you know, what song is going to start the first side, what song is going to end the first side, how's the second side going to start, how's the record going to end. Like, in the CD era, like, people got used to, how's the record going to start, how's it going to end, that's it. But it's like vinyl. I had a producer one point that, you know, called it the four corners of rock and roll. He's like, you were programming for the four corners of rock and roll. And it's like, you wanted to, like, get them at the beginning of the side. And at the end of that side, you wanted to, like, keep them to go, oh my God, I got to flip this over and listen to the rest of the record. So it's just like the sequence was an even more bizarre thing back then.
And we literally lived through that. You know, we that was very much the evolution. I mean, we weren't used to CDs at that stage either, really, you know. CDs were new, so, you know, and it was, and the thing that annoyed us the most about CDs was trying to get the artwork on the fucking things, you know. It's like, hang on, what's this, you know. You know, and as you say, those four corners, you know, that's the way you thought. That was the mentality back then. And you know, it's kind of sad that we don't have that anymore, because it's all part of the art form, you know. It's like, you know, for me, you know, an album was those four corners, you know. You'd have your, you know, people would discuss which side of the record they liked the most, you know, which is an interesting talking point, really, if you think about it. And the fact that you could have that concept actually affects the overall vibe of the whole piece, you know. If you're thinking about, you know, Wolfgang Mozart sitting down writing, you know, if they suddenly changed the way music works for him, he would have, like, lost his mind, you know what I mean? But so that was all part of the art form, was that concept, you know. So when it became CDs, yeah, it just started and it stopped, you know, and which was, you know, an evolution that you just sort of lived through. It wasn't like overnight, so we went with the flow and that was no problem. But by the time we finished our career, there was no vinyl, you know, sort of thing. So
yeah, for sure. What do you dig about the new remix that folks are going to hear of Listen Like Thieves as an album? Obviously, Giles is somebody that's been in your camp for a good long while now, which is cool.
He has. Yeah, he has. And I was one of, Kirk and I basically were the ones that listened really intensely to those. We'd go into the studio and listen to his mixes and get back to him with notes, and we've done that throughout the whole Atmos remixing process as well, which I've noticed since we started converting the mixes over to Atmos. When Giles first started doing that, first thing we do when we go into the studio to listen to a mix is listen to the stereo mix, and then of a song, not the whole record, just a song, and then say, okay, let's hear the Atmos mix now. And it was like, whoa, wow, you know, it sounds like half the amps have been unplugged or something, or it's just, it had lost that boom, you know. So we were like, nah, it's losing something in the, you know, it just doesn't hit you in the face like it does in the stereo mix. So Giles was like, oh, okay, all right, good feedback, and off we go. And then some time later, must have been a while, he came back with more mixes, and it was like, yeah, now that's more like it. And suddenly that, you know, there was all these, we started noticing all these things we'd forgotten about in the mixes, because in a stereo mix, you know, and that's part of, again, that's part of the art form as well. With mixing, if you work with what you got, and in a stereo mix, you're able to get this texture that works well in stereo. But when you start going to 11 speakers, right, and it starts to get really interesting, because But not many people could actually listen to it like that anyway, you know. You know, if you're fortunate enough to have a car with an Atmos stereo system in it, then not many people do. I mean, although that quite a few do these days. You know, a car's a great place to listen to music, you know, and you can be that analytical yes. like that. You know, there's quite, for me, there's nowhere quite as that I get to do to listen to music other than in the studio is in the car. You know, like when you're in the car, you're kind of like in your own studio, you know, and it's like if my wife hums and sings to music while I'm in the car, I'm like, she gets the stink eye from me in a big way because I'm like, look, I don't see your credits on the record here, hun. You know, like, it's like I like to hear music in its purity. But so it was, you know, at first it was a bit shocking. And I think, to be honest, I'll find out on Monday night just what Chris thinks of the mixes of Listen Like Thieves. I'm sure he'll tell me.
Yeah.
But, you know, because, well, obviously he and the Martin family go way back. So, but look, Giles is, since we first started working with Giles, he's, to me, he's really like become a tour de force of, you know, he's really, he really understands us. And I actually really love the mixes. See, it's not, Chris was never really a mixing engineer so much, as, you know, as a producer. So he sort of, you know, he never actually does the mixing. He has is a mixing engineer, like Bob Clearmountain mixed Kick, for instance, you know. But Chris is heavily involved in them, obviously. I actually really love the mixes of Listen Like Thieves, the new ones. I won't say more, but easily just as much as the original. The reason is because it's exciting again. You know, it's like, yeah. I get these chills from hearing all these things that you don't hear in a stereo mix, and for me that makes it infinitely more interesting and takes me back. It's hard to separate myself from the band as a pure listener. I've always struggled with that because when it's your creation or you're part of it, it's really hard to be objective and you know, I'm always fascinated by what other people think because, you know, it's coming from within, you know, it's your experience that other people are listening to, and it's difficult to remove yourself from that first person.
One thing I wanted to ask about was you mentioned Nile Rodgers and working with Nile on Original Sin. Like, what do you think you guys took away from the experience of working with Nile?
Well, that's a good question. You know, he was just kind of encouraging. He really liked things to, he had his, I mean, it was coming straight off the back of the Bowie album, Let's Dance, and working with the Sims Brothers as backing vocalists. They came in and sang on Original Sin as well. And he, at the same time, Niall was recording Hall & Oates, you know. So Daryl Hall came in and sang on Original Sin as well. So we had this host of, and of course our big thing was the combination of Michael's voice and Kirk's voice. So somehow we got that's still really obvious, but there's these other great singers doing the backing vocals. So
which was a thing in the 80s.
It was a thing of the 80s, that's right. And you know, there was that classic Nile Rodgers guitar sound that was my inspiration for a lot of things, and that you know, to this day, I, you know, in the studio, I you know, he turned me on to Tokai guitars, and their reissues of the Fender Strats. And that was one of the, you know, one of the things he used on the Bowie album. And I said, you know, how'd you get that sound on China Girl? And I remember him saying on this telecaster, sorry, the Stratocaster that this company called Tokai make, do you want me to hook you up? And I was like, yeah. As it turned out, we were going straight to Japan from the States. And this Tokai representative met me at the airport and proceeded to give me like 40 guitars, you know. I was like, thanks, Niall. And that carried on throughout my career. I ended up using Tokais a lot. On the Wembley album, the Wembley show, you know, apart from my tried and trusted Fender Tele that I played on every record, just about, the rest of the guitars were my Tokais, you know.
Yeah.
And Chris was really into that as well, particularly the Tokai Talbos. I don't want to get too technical about that stuff, but they were an important part of my sound, and along with the Fender Tele. And Chris was, you know, totally aware of that and utilized that. And he loved that whole combination of that chorus sound that was so big in the 80s, you know, putting an edge to it or cleaning it right up or however it was going to be. Like, I'm thinking along the lines of Kiss the Dirt, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an interesting track in itself. It kind of has different genres in it in the one song, you know. Something we found when we went to America for the first time, you know, is that our publicists and record companies were like, okay, they were talking, you know, they were talking in jargon we didn't understand, which was, you know, you're doing great on Top 40, and on college you're doing really well, and on alternative and all this stuff. And we're like, what the hell are you guys talking about? And they're talking about all the different kinds of radio, you know. And that was just totally new to us, because in Australia you have sort of, you have, you know, either, you know, Sebastian Bach on the ABC, or you had modern music, you know. You didn't have all these different, you know, radio stations that played different kinds of music. So, and one of the big questions was like, you know, what sort of music would you call yourselves, you know? And we were like, oh, I don't know. You know, rock, you know, pop, A&O or whatever it is, you know. It was a whole new thing, and we didn't really want to start thinking that way, you know. We wanted to keep pursuing whatever it was that we wanted to do, you know, dance, you know, radio. We wanted to appeal to them all, you know, not because we wanted specifically to appeal to the masses. It was like, because that's how we felt just about music. Is that there was a bit of everything in us, you know, whether it be the Brothers Johnson or the Bee Gees or whatever it was. They were all part of our influences, you know, both Skaggs to Little Feet to Steely Dan, you know, to these people, you know, the Doobie Brothers and whatnot, were just as important to us as the Sex Pistols and the Clash, you know. And so when that's your influence, you know, you're going from the Clash to Steely Dan, you know, it's an interesting blend, you know. And so we couldn't imagine ourselves just being played on one genre of radio.
Last couple things. I think it's really intriguing to hear that you were hearing things like Little Feet. How were you guys hearing things like Little Feet?
Oh, when we were the Farris Brothers, we covered Little Feet. And a lot of those bands I just mentioned, even Michael Franks, you know, that's the stuff we were listening to. But at the same time, we were, you know, it was the late 80s. So, you know, punk and the punk influences, you know, even bands like Blondie, you know, that now they could write a pop song.
Oh, yeah. You know,
that they were absolutely genius. And you know, that they're all our influences. So we were like this melting pot, and particularly because as individuals, we all had a kind of our, you know, our own thing going, you know, like I was probably more into, like, for Roxy Music and The Clash were probably my two all-time favorite bands ever. And that led on to, you know, 801 and Phil Manzanera's thing. And we covered a bit of that.
Record.
It is a great record. You know, he was a great guitarist. He's a great guitarist. Still one of my idols. You know, so, and Chris, and every time we'd say something like, you know, about our influences and stuff like that, or a lot of the times, like, it was this one time we were sitting, when we were making Listen Like These, Chris sat, we're all sitting in the control room, and Chris said, okay, well, who's your favorite, what's your favorite record? You know, and he'd point to Andrew, and he'd say, I don't know, something by Little Feet maybe, or whatever. And when it came to me, I said, For Your Pleasure by Roxy Music. And Chris said, oh, I produced that. And I was like, no way. I couldn't, you know, he said, yeah, I produced 7 Roxy Music albums. And I was like, no fucking way. I didn't even know that. You know, I raced home and got out the vinyl, and there it was, huge letters, produced by Chris Thomas. So I was like, oh my God, Eno and all those guys. And that was such a great record, you know. So that was a really interesting experience. You know, that was just what it was like recording with him, and that therefore it made us feel more like we were like doing something important now with him. You know, our music and you know, the concerts we were selling out now, and we were, the fact that we'd had this following now in the USA, which we weren't expecting to happen as fast as it did. And there was this like hungry tiger being the US for our music, and all we had to do was feed it. And so we were careful about what we fed it. And that was meant working with someone like Chris. And of course, so when we finished What You Need, we all felt like we'd just got started. So when it came to the next record, there was no one else were interested in recording with at that point other than Chris Thomas.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So, all right, here's my final question, because everything you just said, I could jump off in another 12 directions, but we won't. So final question here. Everything that we've been talking about as far as Listen Like Thieves goes, you know, the overhead view, like you spending time immersed back in the time of this record, as you have been involved with everything that has brought us this set that people are going to hear, what really came back to you about this record as a whole that was interesting?
I've forgotten about the song Same Direction. And and that, you know, I'd completely forgotten about it. But when I sat in the studio listening to the mixes, I was like, wow, you know, this brings back all those great feelings I had about recording that song. I loved everything about recording that song. And I love the song, you know, it's my favorite song on the record. Because it mixes so many genres again, you know, and it was this unusual kind of song, you know. In retrospect, it sounds a little bit Duran Duran-ish, which I think is which is maybe why Duran Duran sounded the way they do. not the other way around. But anyway, they're great people, and we used to have a lot of fun leaving notes and stuff with those guys. You know, it was just,
I think everybody had fun with Duran Duran in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and Michael was very close with Simon and his wife, Ali. But anyway, so that song represented, I don't know, the sum of all parts for me for that record. It was that's kind of the Talbot sound I got on the guitar with the Floyd Rose whammies, and it was just you know, the rat pedal and all that stuff. It was just really, really good fun. And it's the same on Kick. My Calling All Nations was my favorite song on that record. And for the same reason, you know, it was this mixture of genres. But you know, Listen Like Thieves, I'm so glad we're giving it this treatment now, because it's such an important record for NXS, and I think it's really interesting. It's a real interesting timestamp.
I agree, and it sometimes feels like this record gets a little bit lost in the shadow of Kick. So it's like it.
Absolutely.
It's nice to kind of, yeah, it's nice to put like
yeah.
The
there
light
wouldn't
on
have
it again.
Been a Kick if it hadn't been for Listen Like Thieves, you know.
Yeah,
it just wouldn't have happened, you know.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for the time. It's always good to talk music with you, and
same,
congrats,
Matt,
on this set.
I was so stoked when I saw it was you we were talking to today. So I prepared my beard just for you, man.
I appreciate that. I tried to. I'm still working on mine. I'll try to get it a little bit more fleshed out for next time we talk. Well, thank you, Tim, man.
All right, man.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening, and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.